The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating and letting people know about the program. We noticed a huge spike of listeners in the last number of weeks, so thank you very much for that. Coming up on this week's episode, we're going to be talking about the power of seaweed. That's it. I'm not going to tell you more. If you'd like to email us, science@newstalk.com, you can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science, and we get to all of those at the end of the podcast. Before we get into the news round, though, I mean, and I know I don't get into politics a lot in the program, and that there's a good reason for that. If you want to know my political leanings, you could probably follow me on Twitter. But I think I'd like to say I have a huge amount of sympathy and support for the protests that have been going on, looking for racial justice, not just in America, but across the world. And Ireland may not have Trump or many white supremacists, but we do have racism, some of it blatant, but much more of it entwined in our social systems. And just because we've had this week, if you see racism around you, call it out, show the victim. You don't condone that behavior. Right. Let's have a look at our first story, shall we? Dr. Lara Dungan joins me, as is Dr. Fergus McCullough from iCrag, to go through the week's stories. And there's some good ones this week. Our first story.
Ah, good data. We are more alike than unlike, my dear Captain. My chemical nutrients are like your blood. If you prick me, do I not leak?
Is about synthetic red blood cells, Lara. And this is very exciting.
This is very exciting. We've got a couple of really good stories this week. And this is a story that's come, it's been published in ACS Nano, which is a journal. And it comes from joint work between the University of New Mexico and universities in China. And the holy grail is to produce synthetic human cells, to be able to then obviously use them and mass produce them to replace whatever is missing in a human. And red blood cells are a particularly interesting target because they're quite simple. They don't even have a nucleus. So they basically, all they really have to be able to do is move around the body. So they have to be able to smush down to be very small and then to go back to their normal shape. They have to be able to carry oxygen and they have to be able to last. They usually last about 120 days. And this new paper has gone towards creating synthetic versions of pretty good red blood cells. And the best way to picture it is if you picture paper mache that we all used to do in school, or papier mache. And what you do is you take a balloon. If you're fancy. And you take a balloon. I suppose in this case, the balloon is the red blood cell. So I suppose you're picturing more like a water balloon than an air balloon. But you take the balloon, and in the paper, they covered the red blood cell with silica. And then they coated that silica with a type of lab-made polymer. So that's like the paper mache on the outside. And then what they did was they scraped all of the cell and the silica and everything out of the polymer and just left this polymer that is the shape of a red blood cell, but that's very malleable. So you could squish it and it goes back to the right shape. And then it's like they took, say, the balloon out of the paper mache, took the skin of the balloon and stretched it all around the outside again so that it's a lovely malleable material, but it looks like a red blood cell to the body. And then because it's empty, they can pack it with whatever they want. They can pack it with hemoglobin, which is what carries oxygen around the body. They can pack it with drugs that, for instance, could treat cancer. They could pack it with things that could detect toxins. They could virtually do almost anything with it. And they injected it into mice and they found that they were still present 48 hours later. So they hadn't been completely destroyed by the mouse immune system, which is exactly what you want. And the mice themselves are still alive 4 weeks later. So it's so exciting. And it sort of brings a whole start to this new idea of creating cells in labs that we can use. Now, we're miles away from it being massively useful to humans, but if we can get it right and mass produce it, then, you know, I don't see why not.
It doesn't seem like there's a lot of engineering to this. I mean, obviously, how to get there, but like from the basic concept, it makes it sound like the red blood cell is a very simple sort of inert piece of biology. Is that the case? Are they not more complicated than that? It makes it sound like they've just made a rubber cup.
Yeah, I suppose essentially they are incredibly complex in the grand scheme of things, but compared to other cells, they're not. And the way they got around the complexity is to take a red cell membrane and just stretch it across their empty, inert cup, as you said, so that they have their lovely cup, but they don't have to deal with any of creating the complexity of a red cell membrane because they just use a real one and stretch it around the outside. So, you know, they are a very complex creation, red blood cells, but compared to other cells, they are actually relatively simple. You know, they're little biconcave cells, and they have very few jobs that they have to do, and they haven't even got a nucleus.
Well, I mean, why not just use red blood cells?
So, I mean, that is a good point. And at the moment, it is obviously far cheaper and far easier to just ask people to donate blood and just use red blood cells. But if you look at it in a grander scheme, in that you could use them to deliver cancer drugs to a very specific location in the body, you could use them to detect toxins. You know, if these were just in people's blood all the time and they were ready to detect toxins that may or may not occur, they could also, in some ways, they could add little magnetic particles, which means that they could target them to certain tissues if there was tissues that they needed to treat things with. Wow. So the sky is the limit in terms of what they can do. I mean, at the moment, it's much easier to ask people to donate blood. And you know, hopefully people will still get out there and still donate blood at the moment because it's really, really important. But, you know, I think it's the extra little added things that these cells might be able to do that are really fascinating.
I remember someone talking about the possibility of synthesizing red blood cells and making them deliver oxygen much quicker, much better. That would allow us to run much further by getting oxygen to our skeletons, that we'd be able to run a marathon much easier than we have before. Do any of these cells have that ability to perform better than actual blood cells?
Well, at the moment, they're using normal hemoglobin. And one of the issues with delivering oxygen to tissues is that hemoglobin has a specific speed at which it can offload its oxygen and you know, load back in carbon dioxide. So you would have to definitely look at changing hemoglobin itself. But, you know, increasing the sheer number of red blood cells would be able to do that. That's why people take drugs like EPO. Certain cyclists who shall remain nameless have been convicted of taking drugs like this. But hemoglobin would be the real key in changing how fast you could offload oxygen. Right. So these can't do it, but definitely people, I'm sure, are researching that somewhere in the world.
Fergus, our second story is a wonderful discovery using a type of radar called LIDAR.
Yes, so I guess for years, archaeology and archaeologists have sort of been stereotyped as like slashing their way through jungles, trying to find evidence of lost civilizations and frequently just staring at the ground from, you know, only 6 feet away. But things over the last few years have really started to change in archaeology, and they've really been revolutionized by a technique called LIDAR. So LIDAR is similar to radar. So radar is radio detection and ranging, and LIDAR is light detection and ranging. And what it does is that it uses lasers that are based on planes which shine down onto the ground and are able to detect really small anomalies or differences or changes in the level of the ground. And then those signals are reflected back up to the plane, they're captured, and then using GPS, they're plotted, and they're able to build up really elaborate 3D maps of ancient structures. And that's exactly what happened this week in the news in a particular area of Mexico known as the Tabasco state, believe it or not, where they found an ancient Mayan ceremonial temple.
Yeah, this LIDAR, I remember it was part of the kit that went on the Copernicus satellite for the European Space Agency's program to basically replace their dependence on American satellites. And one of the things I remembered is that it could detect on an underground subway subsidence of a millimeter. And I was like, that's incredible. It's a huge amount of detail with this, but it's not small things they found. This is an enormous site they found.
Yes, and so the reason that it has only been found in the last couple of years and just published this week was because it was actually too big to be seen. So the size of the ceremonial complex was 400 meters wide and 1400 meters long. So that is absolutely enormous. It was about 10 to 15 meters in height, and it had been sort of, the top of it had effectively been covered in woodland and covered in agricultural land. So in a way, it just naturally fitted in with the landscape. And as you were walking along the surface, you would never actually realize. And it was only with the use of LiDAR that they were able to take a grand sort of airplane view of it, shine the lasers down, and then make this magnificent discovery. Now, such is the size of this ceremonial complex that they found that they've somehow managed to come up with a calculation as to how long it would have taken to build this ceremonial complex. And this is one of the things I love about archaeology, is how they managed to come up with these numbers. So they estimate that this Mayan temple would have taken between 10 million and 13 million person days to actually build. So what that means in real money is that it would take about 200 years to actually build. And I find that really interesting, because that means that, you know, the people who start out building it, you know, in a way they know that they're never going to see its final construction. And actually that is, in a way, that is one of the most interesting parts about this particular discovery of the Mayan temple, is that there was no clear evidence of big statues or the traditional really, really high classical Mayan pyramids, because often those pyramids or often those statues are there to sort of revere the upper echelons of society, or they might be used sort of to as interment places for kings or queens. And what this suggests is that the absence of things like that means that this particular early form of Mayan civilization was actually really egalitarian. It was quite equal, and it needed a collective effort of people working over numerous generations to actually create a structure of this size.
Sounds like the National Children's Hospital.
A little bit like the National Children's Hospital.
People working on that, you know, they start working on it, but they'll never see what it actually looks like. You know, it'll be three generations later we actually get it. I think that is awesome. And I think it'll be really interesting to see what they do. But I mean, presumably they're going to have to dig that up, right? And yes, that would become an enormous... I mean, I don't know if it's a boon for the industry or if it's a disaster for the industry, but presumably you have to dig that up and see what it looks like and restore it potentially. Do they have any plans to do that?
Yeah, so they have taken some samples and core samples and things like that, and they've done some radiocarbon dating and they have found some artifacts. But the actual excavation of the entire site, I don't know if that is on their radar. Excuse the pun, uh-huh. But it would be an enormous piece of work. It looks like with LiDAR that they've managed to tell a reasonably comprehensive story, and using sort of the point sampling, they managed to build up quite a nice picture of the size of the site and its role. So I'm not sure whether they'll actually dig the whole thing up. I think that might run into numerous problems, right, simply from the size of the site.
Wow, it's amazing to think that might be there and just left there. It's something so big that could be, you know, the Taj Mahal equivalent if that's what someone wanted to do, you know, this huge national tourist site. Our third story is an old story in a way, and has to do with the Dead Sea Scrolls, Lara.
Yeah, another one that I just think is really fascinating, and it's just a neat little bit of research that was done. For anyone who doesn't know, which is very few people, the Dead Sea Scrolls are around about 25,000 different pieces of parchment that were found in caves in Qumran, which is an area of Israeli-occupied West Bank. And they contain a lot of historical and biblical text, but some of the pieces are very big. The vast majority of the pieces are absolutely tiny. And the job since the 40s and 50s, when these were found, has been to try and piece them together. And people think that they have achieved a certain amount of that. And obviously for the larger pieces, it's easier to do. But for the smaller pieces, this is insanely difficult. And what they've done in a research that was just published in Cell magazine, actually, which is a very well-renowned journal, is they DNA tested some of the smaller parts. And what they found was that they were, for instance, parts that they thought were part of the same parchment or were part of the same prose actually came from completely different animals. So some were cowhide, some were sheephide. So they know now that they can separate them out. Other parts that they weren't sure whether they went together or not, they can see came from all sheep, but sheep that were definitely raised in the same area. So they were genetically very similar sheep, so likely from the same herd, which I just think is so cool. And what they can do now is they can feed all of this information into an artificial intelligence machine, which is already trying to piece them together. But with this extra level of fascinating material, they should be able to come closer to seeing what was written on some of the smaller parts of these Dead Sea Scrolls.
Which is really, really cool. And it essentially, it's trying to put together pieces from a shredder in a language that people don't understand, about a text that they don't fully, you know, these are tiny pieces of parchment in some cases.
Absolutely.
And if you ever see, you know, a display of these, you're talking about like less than half a postage stamp, some of these fragments. So a really interesting text, though. And actually, I got an email in from someone who's been doing some mathematical work on the Dead Sea Scrolls and has been able to identify amazing levels of numeracy from these texts. Wow. So yeah, so it's a really, really interesting story.
Such a cool study.
And great that DNA can sort of start piecing those things together.
Presumably, and these are over 2,000 years old as well. It's just really fascinating to be able to get this DNA of over 2,000 year old cows and sheep.
Presumably there's no human DNA. I mean, like, I know in CSI you get to see someone smudge their lipstick on a glass and then it's sent off to a lab.
Yeah.
I presume the fingerprints of the readers and writers of these scrolls are unlikely to leave any DNA.
No, I mean, there would be such tiny traces. They wouldn't be around 2,000 years later, I'm afraid. Not with our current technology. Maybe in the future, you know, if we get better.
Our final story has to do with animals that I've been seeing quite a lot of recently, urban foxes, who have, to my great amusement, been leaving the oddest pieces of clothing and belongings in my neighbor's garden. So size 10 running shoes, a briefcase, a t-shirt, a book. That for some reason the fox seems to be gathering these random items from somewhere. I'm sure there's some residents of Monkstown going, who stole one shoe? They're urban foxes and they are adapting in the UK.
Yes, they they're certainly adapting to your neighbor's house as well, if they're dropping in briefcases and things like that. I've never heard
it's
of
a city fox.
Is a city, yeah, a learned literate fox. So the I guess one of the reasons that foxes are so active at the moment is that they've just come out of mating season. So the mating season for foxes is January to March, and that is where you might hear a lot of those sort of blood curdling screams at night, the sound of the banshee. That's the sound of the female fox during mating season, and it's a signal that the vixen is in heat. But it's from May to June that a lot of those cubs are born, and this is one of the periods of time that foxes are actually most active, when they're trying to collect food for their pups. But I really can't see how they can feed briefcases to pups or anything like that. But
it's bizarre.
There has been, it is completely bizarre. But maybe researchers from the University of Glasgow can help your neighbour out like this, because they published a study this week in the Proceedings of the Royal Society, whereby they compared the skulls of urban foxes to rural foxes. And what they found is that, on average, urban foxes' skulls and snouts are getting shorter and smaller than their rural companions. Wow. So one of the sort of lines of thinking here is that if you have a shorter snout, that confers higher mechanical advantage to the jaw. And what that means is that the urban foxes that are sort of rooting around in dustbins and rubbish piles and stuff like that, often they have to break open casing to actually reach the food that is inside that has been left behind by humans. And so having the shorter snout increases the mechanical advantage, allowing them to break open those casings. The downside of it versus the rural foxes is that it's much less advantageous when it comes to actually catching wild prey, because it slows the closing speed of the jaw. So if you're chasing after something like a hare or a rabbit or a mouse or something like that, it's harder for urban foxes to catch prey, per se. So that appears to be why we're having this sort of differentiation between urban and rural foxes. And it's actually something that's well known. And it's called domestication syndrome. And what that is that it's stereotypical change that occurs across species as they move to becoming effectively domesticated. So they're more docile, their coat color changes, their total brain size reduces, and their teeth get smaller. And all of these are sort of characteristics of what happens to wild animals as they are living with or domesticated by humans.
Do we know, Lara, how much of this change would have to happen before we would call this a different species?
To be honest with you, it would be a lot of change that would have to happen, because even these kind of changes are very unlikely to change them chromosomally. So, I mean, you'd be talking about really probably hundreds of thousands of years, I would suspect.
All right. So it's a chromosomal change that changes the species, is it?
Yeah. I mean, it really, you have to be able to interbreed. You have to be able to not interbreed anymore. Now, I know that things like lions and tigers can interbreed and they are different species, but you have to be able to produce fertile young. So I can't see these small changes bringing the rural and the urban foxes far enough away that they have infertile young. So I mean, I would estimate probably hundreds of thousands of years. But I mean, it's fascinating that the changes even in this small amount of time.
Well, if not being able to mate anymore makes you a different species, I'm sure there's lots of husbands and wives at home that are now considering themselves non-homo sapiens. What can we learn from this, Fergus? I mean, should we be trying to stop urban foxes from doing this sort of behavior? Is it bad for them that they're doing this, or is it just adapting to living alongside humans?
Yeah, it's an adaptation to living alongside humans. And actually this study was carried out in the UK, but the number of foxes in the UK, or in England in particular, has increased fivefold in the last 25 years, and they've become really, really common in people's back gardens. So strangely, it seems that foxes are actually getting on quite well living in urban areas, and it's really only one of the main things that actually reduces fox populations is actually diseases that they just carry themselves. It's not necessarily to do with interactions with humans. Having said that, the general advice would be, you know, like not to feed foxes. They are still wild animals. You know, they haven't been domesticated like a dog. So observe from a distance. If you're lucky enough to see some fox cubs at the moment, just make sure that you don't, you know, that they don't see you, or that you stand in such a way that they can't smell you and things like that, and just enjoy them for what they are.
Very good. Well, Dr. Fergus McAuliffe from iCraig and Dr. Lara Duggan, thanks very much as always.
Thanks, Johnny.
Thanks.
Hey, do you remember climate change? It hasn't gone away, you know. I know what you're thinking. Not now, Jonathan. There's other things going on in the world. But our next guest is actually proposing a solution. Seaweed. What am I talking about? Well, Tim Flannery is co-founder of the Australian Climate Council. He joins me now. Tim, you're very welcome to the program. This idea that you have to use seaweed to fight climate change, give us an opener. What's the idea?
Yeah, look, it's great to be with you, Jonathan. And look, I guess seaweed, or growing seaweed, is a pretty old idea. People have been using seaweed for a long time. But with the growing urgency of addressing climate change, scientists have turned their mind to how we can use that old idea to address this more recent problem of climate change. And seaweed is very good at doing it, because the seaweed grows very fast. All seaweeds grow pretty fast, but the larger varieties such as giant kelp grow particularly fast. They can grow up to a metre a day. And as they do that, they capture a lot of carbon out of the ocean water. You know, the ocean's a strange place. There's an entire atmosphere worth of gas dissolved into the oceans. So that's what the seaweed feed on. They feed on the CO2 in that atmosphere worth of gas dissolved in the oceans. They grow very fast. They fix a lot of that CO2 as living tissue in the seaweed. And it's then there until the seaweed rots. But then you have somewhere to store all of that carbon, which is effectively the deep ocean.
How effective per cubic meter is seaweed at trapping CO2 in comparison to trees?
Well, if you look at the growth rates, you know, there's not many trees that grow a meter a day. Mm. So seaweed is pretty good at capturing the carbon. The big issue then, of course, is storing it. Now, in a tree on land, the carbon will be stored for as long as that tree is alive, or perhaps as a piece of timber in a building. But a lot of the carbon, of course, returns to the atmosphere when the tree is burned or when it decomposes on the forest floor. Whereas for the seaweed, if we can get the carbon in the seaweed into the deep ocean, that's below a kilometre, we have a place where that carbon will be stored for thousands, hundreds or perhaps thousands of years.
It sounds like you're talking about dumping into the oceans. There's probably a number of issues with that, but let's take them one by one. That's just putting off the CO2 rise, right, by putting all this stuff in the bottom of the ocean.
Well, the truth of the matter is that we don't really know. Certainly some of the carbon that would reach the deep ocean over the thousands of years it takes for the ocean circulation to complete a lap, you know, some of it will return to the surface thousands of years from now, but some of it may be incorporated into submarine sediments, carbonates and so forth in its long journey through the oceans. And look, I take entirely what you're saying about dumping into the oceans. I mean, that's a serious consideration, especially when you look at the volumes of seaweed that would be required to deal with climate change. But, you know, as we learn more about the oceans, we see there is some precedent for this in that a lot of seaweed naturally gets swept into the deep oceans, and the carbon in that seaweed is stored down there. And, you know, the recent studies done suggest that very large volumes of seaweed make it into the deep oceans. And the other thing we have to keep in mind is how big the deep ocean is compared with the atmosphere. So the ocean as a whole is 500 times larger than the atmosphere, yeah? So if we think about taking half of the carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere out of the atmosphere and putting it into the deep oceans, you would halve the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, but increase the concentration of CO2 in the deep oceans by only 2%. So the idea of dumping, we have to temper it with some sense about the relative sizes and natures of these various organs of our planet.
Yeah, but what are we talking about? I mean, are we talking about a continent of seaweed? Because I'm trying to imagine what sort of amount of seaweed could possibly capture that much carbon. And where does that seaweed continent go?
Sure. Well, look, you've got to grow the seaweed somewhere where it can get into the deep oceans for a start. So, you know, the heads of submarine canyons is a good place. There's 660 mapped submarine canyons around the peripheries of continents that might be useful to start with. Around some of the world's islands as well are good places. But the truth is you've got to do this on a large scale.
How large?
Well, if you want to, say, take 1 gigaton, 1 billion tons, of CO2 out of the atmosphere per year, you'd be looking at planting an area the size of South Australia in seaweed. Now, that is very large from today's perspectives. But, you know, seaweed farming today takes up enormous areas. I mean, in the Yellow Sea alone, there's at least 500 square kilometres of seaweed farm off the coast of China. You go to a place like Korea and look at the seaweed farms and they go on forever. So, you know, we're talking here about a future application of an old technology, and it does seem overwhelmingly large. But when we ask ourselves, how else could we deal with this problem? It puts in perspective the necessity to take CO2 out of the air and the great difficulty of doing it by any means. And seaweed is just one of those areas where at least it seems possible.
So planting these enormous seaweed farms around the world in convenient spaces is one thing, but what about the changes to the natural ecosystem? Obviously, any increase in the circle of life, as we've learned from Lion King, on one side leads to problems on the other side, right?
Well, that's right. Yeah. And, you know, if you think about seaweed farming today, often it's just seaweed that's grown. But increasingly in the more sophisticated ranching or farming areas, you know, using the oceans. People also grow fish and shellfish and whatever else in among the seaweed. And the reason they do that is because the seaweed, by drawing the CO2 out of the atmosphere, buffer the acidity of the seawater. So they make the seawater less acid, and that really allows for optimum growth of anything that has a skeleton or a shell. So you get very good conditions to grow your marine protein, if you want. Now, you know, we've got to think of this as a whole system. So there's the impact around the seaweed farm. But of course, that the seaweed that you cut to go down to the ocean bottom, we don't know exactly what happens to it down there. It formed part of the marine snow drift that gets down into the deep. But that, as if any of it decomposes, would suck oxygen from that deep ocean water as well. So we have to understand a lot more now about the system as a whole, as you quite rightly point out. Now, I've spent a decade looking at this stuff, and there's probably three or four scalable options. And seaweed seems to me one of the most prospective one for the reason you identified, which is that it's part of the Earth's natural process.
So let's talk practical terms. How do you grow this seaweed? Presumably that is one of the engineering questions. How do you grow and manage these seaweed farms? Do they need different type of nutrients to grow in the way we want them to? How do you manage their movement? Would these farms be policed by robots or boats to make sure they don't go, or that would they be netted and vertical? Talk me through the yeah. engineering side of what needs to be figured out.
Sure. Well, look, the propagation of seaweed is something that's fairly well understood now. You know, seaweeds have an unusual life pathway. There's two forms, the sexual reproductive phase and the asexual phase. And, you know, you have to have both, and you have to master the technology to propagate the seaweed in order to grow it at scale. And that is all relatively well understood. We know that the seaweed needs sunlight. It needs a framework to as a holdfast, and it needs nutrients. So you need those three things together. So the vision at the moment is that you would have a floating framework in the ocean, the deep ocean, where you have, say, a kilometer of water under you.
Like a scaffold?
A scaffold of some sort, whatever it is, that would allow the seaweed to have a holdfast. No one has really thought through how you would maintain and run these farms in the longer term, but there's been some experimental work on other issues, such as getting the nutrients to the farms. So, you know, the mid-ocean, away from the land, the ocean is a biological desert for very good reason. There's plenty of sunlight, but there's no nutrients. Mm. But 300 metres below, once you get below the sunlit zone of the ocean, there's a lot of cold water, which is very nutrient rich.
Oh.
So, you know, if you want to get those nutrients up that 300 metres or so, you know, one option is to lower a pipe and use wave power or solar power or something else to develop the 2 metres of head pressure that you need to bring that cold water to the surface. Once you bring it to the surface, it surprisingly will stay there, even though it's colder than the water at the surface, because it's less salty. So it's buoyant.
Hmm.
So you can irrigate your farms, your seaweed farms, by using that water. And that's one of the areas which is being tested now, and has been tested and shown that this can be done. But, you know, this is, if you ask me how many floating seaweed farms there are in the mid-ocean of the world today, I'd have to answer you, there are none at all. So these are things that have to be worked on if we want to have a scalable solution for the future.
Okay, then these farms, are they expected to stay in one place? Are they tethered in some way? Presumably you couldn't tether them. So how do you keep them from arriving on the shores?
Yeah, well, you know, what I've been looking at is the doldrums, you know, that large area of the tropic, the horse latitudes, where things are quite calm, conditions are calm, and you would have less stress on the physical structure. You could have them mobile, and there may be some great benefits to having them kind of on autopilot, if you want, going around the ocean, because the seaweed that they drop would be distributed much more evenly. It wouldn't create just one great stinking pile in the one spot. And you could, if you were running farms of that nature, you know, bring the farm closer to a point where you could harvest, for example, a marine protein, the fish and the shellfish that you're growing in that floating farm. Once you'd want to bring that nearer to market to harvest that, and then perhaps let the thing go off again on a sort of a robotic autopilot around the oceans. And of course, you have to take account of the possibility of collisions with shipping and so forth, but all of that I think is manageable. It's the bigger economic issues around this and the political issues that are the things that are loom larger, I think.
So I give you $1 trillion tomorrow. How quickly could you put this in place?
Well, that's a great question. I think the first thing I'd do is commission a map of the ocean so I'd know where we could do this most optimally. You know, it'd be lovely to know where that sweet spot is between those 660 marine canyons, major human population centres that could be taking the marine protein, and the weather, the local weather. I think if you had $1 trillion, you said, I reckon you'd make some pretty good progress in a decade. I think we'd certainly test the idea and we'd have some sense of scale within a decade. But the kind of place I'd begin to do that would be some of the Pacific Ocean islands, because those islands are suffering disproportionately from climate change. Mm. Their waters are being pillaged by illegal fishing quite often. And for them, if they could use those huge marine waters they control to pilot some work in this area, I think it'd be good for their local economies, it'd be good for kind of a sense of global justice, and it'd give us a good sense of how scalable this solution is. And look, to be honest, if the solution isn't scalable, if we find there are insurmountable problems, I will feel that I've done my bit, and I'll say, what's next? Let's test the next idea, because we're running out of time to deal with this problem. We need to start testing these ideas and working out what is viable and what is not in the drawdown space.
I know that in talking about this, you often reference the graph of how much progress we've had in our quest to decrease global warming, and that is none. And I'm wondering, even if we managed to build this dream, right? Say we build seaweed farms, we pilot them within 10 years, we decide this is the way to go, and we manage to take a gigaton of carbon out of the atmosphere, thus finally and shockingly managing to theoretically slow down the speed of global warming. Aren't human beings just going to add to that? If we're taking the stuff out, aren't people going to say, well, now we can do more? As a climate scientist, I'm always amazed by the optimism and hope and perseverance in the face of knowing what humans are like.
Yeah, look, that's the great moral hazard. And I thought about that long and hard, really. I should just tell you how I've got to this place, Jonathan. I was chair of the Copenhagen Climate Council back in 2009, and I worked incredibly hard for 3 years to try to do my bit to get a global deal to address climate change. And, you know, when we failed at that, I think it was the hardest time of my life. It was really tough. And I knew that at that point, there's no way we could stay safe from climate change, stay below 2 degrees, unless we had some drawdown, because you could just see the emissions going up and up and up. And so I spent the last decade looking at drawdown options, trying to work out what we could possibly do. And as I said, there's 3 or 4 possibilities, and seaweed looked to me to be the best one. So I've just been trying over the last few, years really, to try to get the energy and the momentum to start investigating some of these options, because if we don't have a drawdown, we won't get there. And you're quite right that this is a moral hazard. I mean, you know, if we do get drawdown capacity with seaweed, you're quite right. Some people in the fossil fuel industry may say, oh, that's great, let's go hell for leather. That's our get out of jail free card. We'll keep polluting, you know. But if we don't get drawdown from something like seaweed will sail through the 2-degree barrier anyway. And in my view, the laws of physics and the laws of chemistry and you know, the things that really rule our planet, you can't mess with them, but we can do something about, you know, self-interest and politics. We can introduce a carbon price. We can do something that will make sure that that get-out-of-jail-free card isn't used. So that's why I'm here today talking about seaweed, really.
Well, Tim Flannery, environmentalist and co-founder of the Australian Climate Council, the very best of luck. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's been a pleasure.
All right, it's time to look back at your texts and tweets from last week. And if you remember, we did an unusual thing on the program called Faster Proof. If you didn't hear it, it is essentially a full episode without news round where we just tried to answer as many of your interesting questions over the space of an hour. We only got to 7 in the end. And the problem with asking people to submit questions is there are a lot of people who have some very good questions. So we just didn't get to all of them. And I'm so sorry about that. There were brilliant ones. I'm going to mention some of them here, but we just didn't get to so much of them. And it's quite a bit of effort to put 7 guests and mix that all together and make it work. So we will do it again in a few months, and some of these questions might make it. But just to say thanks hugely to Brian, whose son Daniel, 14-year-old, asked 2 excellent questions. What would happen if light got inside a perfect sphere which was mirrored on the inside? Would it pool at the bottom because of gravity? And we actually asked Becky Smethurst about that, and she said, you know, mirrors are imperfect, so no, it wouldn't. It would eventually just dissipate. But it's a really good question. If those mirrors were perfect is the next question, which so we might explore that one. And he also asked, if light is traveling in the vacuum of space and if it has a clear path, would it ever stop? The answer to that is no. Bob from Blanchardstown asked a question that could possibly do away with the theory of dark matter, dark energy. We're definitely going to look at that. Might chat to John Regan about that. And then some other ones. Eugene said, why can't we tickle ourselves? We had a bunch in from all sorts of people from all sorts of life. Anthony was asking great questions about DNA, mass travel. We had Tony asking about the universe expanding. Niall, Eamon, Colm, Michael, loads of great, great questions. And as I say, to cover all of them in one program would take probably about a day's worth of radio, which we may end up doing at some point, but we just couldn't fit into the hour. Lots of people loved it, so thanks very much for your comments on that. Darren says, great episode. And Eugene, who's never listened to the program before, says, this is the first time listening. Encourage you to do more of this sort of stuff. I mean, I suppose if it's your first time listening, you'd be thinking, wow, that program's awesome. Eamon said the same. He says, the first time writing to a radio station, want to congratulate on today's show. Thoroughly enjoyed it. An occasional listener, but as a non-science person, I found the format riveting. Encourage you to do more of that. I think that's a polite way, Aidan, of saying stop talking about the same subject for 20 minutes. But I don't know, it seems to work for us. I mean, do let us know.
You're such a pessimist.
I know, I'm such a cynic and a pessimist. Aren't I? Yeah. I know, I can turn any compliment into a negative. I get it from my dad. My dad has this amazing ability to give someone a compliment that could also be an insult. So he would say something like, you put a meal in front of him, he'd say, you wouldn't get this in the best restaurant in Dublin.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, oh, you know, it's a funny way about giving compliments. You're never sure if it's actually an insult hidden. So I don't know, maybe that's where my cynicism. In fact, I know that's where my cynicism comes from, because my mom is like a ray of, she's like a bucket of rainbows. And my dad, I don't know. Sometimes dad is like, he can be a bit an empty half bucket.
He can find a cloud in a silver lining.
Yeah. Yeah. He can find a cloud. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah. So listen, thanks very much. And Aidan, the producer, obviously there in the background, obviously it was a lot of work went into it. Thanks very much. How did you choose which questions we were going to do, by the way?
Basically just, well, a combination. It wasn't very scientific. A combination of the ones that were most interesting that came in, but also the ones that came in earliest. Because there was a lot of planning involved, I think we both talked about, and this is why we decided to do Faster Proof too, is that questions started coming in near the end, and you were like, no, this question is interesting, yeah, but I don't have time to get to it. So basically that was our process. It was, you know, ask early and ask interesting and you get in.
Now, I am when I put these things together, one of the things that I really have cultured is avoiding my darling. So whenever it comes to music, the first piece of music that comes to mind is something I always ignore, and I always try and say what is the mood suited to. Sometimes people do literal stuff in radio, right? So if you're talking about handbags, they have a song that says something about handbags, and people go, oh, it was about handbags and this song has handbags in it. I don't think that's particularly creative personally, always. And I like to go one bit further. I'm not talking about you, Aidan, although you are guilty of that. And so I like trying to find some. But this episode, Aidan provided, I think, almost all of the music suggestions. There's a chapeau tip to you from Garode. He says, cool episode today. Love the question about the approaching star. Good thought experiment. Wasn't expecting a sample of Timber Tambor as one of the musical interludes. I tip my hat. Yes, indeed. And you know what? Something that people may not know is that Aidan was the front man to a band called The Gandhis, which is a very successful indie band in Ireland. And then I DJed for many years across the country, but also in other places. And I wonder, is there something we can do with that? Like, could we have a night where we have live music, we finish off with DJing, and we do some science in between? I'll play some 90s bangers with my friend Ivan. Wouldn't that be a good night?
That would be a good night.
What?
Well, we were just complaining about the time we have to put these projects together. Stop coming up with good ideas for projects.
But do you know what? For an event, if we can, you know, welcoming people back post-COVID, I think it'd be a fun thing to do. And
that'd be really nice, actually, yeah.
And the other thing is that DJing, I don't have to do any work for that. You'd obviously have to do rehearsals and stuff. But DJing, yeah. We'd be fine. But yeah, I mean, music obviously is important to me and Aidan, and we think a good bit about the music that goes into those special episodes particularly. So that's it, I guess. Producing this week was Aidan McKelvey. Simon Keane was researching on sound. Giorgio Cardozo. There'll be more Future Proof in this podcast feed, wherever you found it, in the coming week. And we'll be back with more on Saturday 12 on News Talk if you listen to the radio. In the meantime, stay curious.